And today is what may be the last day of our late winter fund drive. And we are here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe with a, I think, delightful program for you. Deborah Madison is with us. She's an internationally acclaimed chef and author of 11 cookbooks. The newest one is called Vegetable Literacy, and she will be at Collected Works on Wednesday evening at 6 o'clock talking about the book. And we will be giving away copies of the book to people who call 428-1393, 428-1393. And make a donation today. Welcome to the Radio Cafe. It's so great to have you back, Deborah.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And so before we talk about the book, which we will do in a minute, and it's a very interesting book, let's talk about KSFR. You are a longtime KSFR listener, is that right?
Oh, yeah, and I've become more so lately. I mean, in the last year, I love KSFR. I listen to it all the time. It's what's on my radio.
Excellent. So the number is 428-1393, and we've got a $1,000 goal for this morning, which we hope we can both meet and exceed. We've been kind of going between $1,000 and $2,000 this morning, I mean, each morning on the Radio Cafe during the fund drive, and we're very happy about that and very proud of that. 428-1393, and Deborah Madison is holding up cash money as the first donation to KSFR.
Yeah.
How kind
of
you. Thank you.
It's my pleasure.
So anybody who donates, I believe the number, now this is a really fantastic book, Vegetable Literacy. It is thick and beautifully illustrated with food photography that just makes your mouth water in a way that I can't even really begin to describe. But if you want to get a copy of the book for an $85 contribution to KSFR, we will send that book right out to you. 428-1393 is the number. So let's talk about this book, Vegetable Literacy. You talk in this book about the 12 families of vegetables that include, I think, most of the stuff that I think when I go shopping and think about what to buy. It's all in there. How did you come across this entire topic?
I'm actually not sure how it happened, but I wanted to at some point look behind the pretty vegetable, you know, and see what made it tick and who it was related to. And I think this began because I had let some carrots go to seed in my garden. And then the second year when they bloomed, they made such gorgeous flowers. And I thought, gosh, they look a lot like parsley, like Queen Anne's lace, like anise, like lots of other plants I knew. And I wonder if they're related. And sure enough, they were. And that was the beginning of seeking out plant families.
So it turns out that the flowers that they make, if they look alike, they probably are in fact related.
They are, but that's not to say that umbels, for example, which is characteristic of the carrot family, which is the umbellifers, umbel flowers also appear in the allium. So it's, you know, but there are other characteristics that set alliums apart from their monocots, not dicots. So that's another way to know what they are. But that is an older classification, is looking at the morphology, which includes the shape of flowers. And they are very consistent throughout plant families.
Now, all vegetables are flowering plants, is that right?
Yes.
And so they flower, and then they make their vegetables, and then they go to seed. Is that
That's the basic. Yeah.
Now, are you've become a gardener. Has that always been part of your cooking practice?
Yes and no. I've always lived, it seems, on a farm or near a farm or had a garden of sorts, usually a pretty limited garden. So, and my father, who's a botanist, grew an amazing garden. So the idea of cooking with food that actually you go out and pick comes from a garden is not exactly new to me. I think it's probably been part of me for a very, very, very long time.
And yet at the same time, as you write about in your book, getting a gardening practice, so to speak, the way people talk about a yoga practice,
yeah,
or something else, it changes your life.
Well, and yes, it does change your life for one, you have to be there to do it. And for so many years, I was on the road as a traveling teacher or a speaker. It seems like I could never stay home long enough to gather the momentum that you need to plant and maintain a garden. It had to be a conscious choice. No, I'm going to stay home. And sure enough, once I did that, I could have a garden.
And I have to say, I was very amused and happy that you compared having a garden to having a puppy.
Well, I also got a puppy at the same time, because since I was home taking care of a garden, I realized at a certain point I could also take care of a dog, you know. And I did get a puppy, and he's just the love of our life.
Little Labradoodle. But this isn't about Labradoodles. We're talking about vegetable literacy with Deborah Madison. And by the way, 428-1393 will get you a copy of that book. Now, let's just talk about the gardening for a moment. As you say in the book, gardening is not only about growing the vegetables, but it's about growing the soil itself. We've got soil problems in this country.
Yeah, we do. They're tired, a lot of them. They're not able to really contribute to the plant so that its vegetable or its fruit can really have all the promises that we're led to believe, especially by nutritionists. You have to have soil that's alive and that's complex and rich, and you know, you're not just growing in a medium. It's not a growing medium. It's more than that.
It's alive by itself.
It has to be. Yeah, it's alive by itself. So, and I think we have sacrificed our soil to monocrops, you know, where we grow the same thing in the same 1,000-acre field year after year, season after season. That's not growing the soil. I really appreciate small farmers, particularly a number of our farmers around here, because they're growing the soil. That's maybe even first in their mind. Then they're growing the vegetables in that soil. And that makes food that really tastes good. And, you know, it's good for you.
So how do you grow the soil in your own garden?
It's so hard. I'm not sure, but it's, you know, I mean, like a lot of gardens here, it seems to be either clay or sand or something gravelly, and organic matter is always the key. And I do make compost. I do put it in. I buy, you know, the soil amendments that everybody buys, which is basically organic matter. And then I use it, you know, I use it with my plants. I'm not a great gardener. I'm not a textbook gardener. I'm just feeling my way. And I do know that if you do start to garden and grow plants and pay attention, you do begin to change what's there. But I think it can sometimes take a long time, especially here.
That's what they say. I mean, it takes a long time not only to learn what you're doing, but for certain things to take root and become comfortable in the garden.
Yeah. There's still things I'm figuring out. Like, I cannot grow grapes for some reason. And they shouldn't be that hard to grow. I mean, I've seen a million vineyards of grapes in the full sun, you know, and rocky, limey soil. And I can't get my grapes to stay alive. And I don't know why this is.
Very interesting.
You know, there's certain, I mean, I somebody asked me, well, do you have a green thumb? I said, uh-uh. You know, I don't. I don't think I do, but I'm just out there giving it a try. Anybody, if I can grow it, anybody can.
Now, your father was a botanist.
Mm-hmm.
How did his work feed into yours?
You know, it's funny. I mean, we always had interesting plants in our garden. And my dad had 10 green thumbs. You know, he'd be on his bicycle going to the university, and he'd see some plant in a trash pile that he thought was interesting. He'd pick it up, he'd take it home at the end of the day and plant it, and it grew.
Right.
Of course, it helps to be in California, but he really could grow things. And my brother is a farmer and also a botanist, and he's the same way. But I didn't pay attention to any of this until I was about 35. It never occurred to me to grow anything.
Even though you were making your life in cooking.
Yeah, and not only that, I went to UC Santa Cruz when Alan Chadwick was there. I saw his beautiful garden. Later he came to Green Gulch Farm and he made another beautiful garden. So it's not like I wasn't looking at gardens, but it didn't occur to me to grow anything until I had this really awful, muddy yard that these prize bulls had lived in. And I thought, this needs something. And I went and got a little plant and planted it. And that was the beginning. I was hooked.
Now, where was that?
That was Green Gulch Farm in Marin County.
In California.
Yes, in California.
And so you had, I love that, that you write about this in the book Vegetable Literacy, which, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, is available for a contribution to KSFR 428-1393. And the phone is ringing, and we love to hear the sounds of phones ringing. We have a $1,000 goal for this hour, 428-1393. Now, this, excuse me, this farm where you, or this area where you started making your first plantings, was a place where bulls had trampled it down?
Yeah, it had been a bullpen on this ranch. And there were two prize Hereford bulls. Well, they weigh over a ton, you know. So they've been walking around on this, not at the same time, but, you know, over a period of 20 years. So it was really compacted clay soil. It was, I had to use a pickaxe to plant anything to make the tiniest holes.
Oh, my goodness. And so for a beginning gardener, what are the first things that you can really do that you think will work, or the first things you did that you can have success with?
I always grow lettuce. Lettuce is easy. Beets, chard, any of the quinopods are pretty easy to grow, I think.
Even in New Mexico?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. In fact, there are a lot of New Mexican natives that happen to be in that family that we don't really see as food plants, but they're all over the place. And some of them we do eat, like quelites, you know, which is lamb's quarters or related to spinach and chard. But four-winged saltbush, for example, is also in that family, and it grows all over the place here.
It's so interesting that we've got things that look like weeds that are food growing on the ground in this very dry land.
Yeah, I think weeds, it's a matter of definition, always.
Right.
You know, I mean, the quelites, they just pop up in my garden every year. I'm so glad they do. They're really delicious.
And then there's purslane.
And purslane, I'm not so crazy about the garden variety, you know, weed purslane, but there is a cultivar you can get called golden purslane. And unlike the one that we have in our gardens, it grows upright. And it has big, fleshy, golden leaves. And they're magnificent. And they're really fun to eat, you know, and to put into a salad. And they self-sow, and they come back every year. And they're really easy to grow.
We're talking to Deborah Madison about her book, Vegetable Literacy. And the number here at the KSFR Fund Drive is 428-1393. And you can get a copy of the book by just giving a quick call. Now, let's talk about some of the specific families of vegetables in this book, Vegetable Literacy. And I think, I mean, just as an overall thing, when you start categorizing and classifying things in the plant families, you can see them better. I mean, that was your big insight.
Exactly. Yeah, it opens your eyes. And suddenly you see, well, there's this great group of plants called the goosefoots. You know, and I thought, well, why do they have that bizarre name, Chenopodia? You know, goosefoot, there it is. And so I went to a farmer who had geese. And I said, could you just pick up one of your geese and show me the foot? And here's this big orange, you know, awful, like, tough-looking claw-like appendage. But I got the shape, and then I could see after that, oh, yeah, okay, spinach has that shape, chard has that shape. It's a little it's a little more narrow, but there's more than one kind of goose, too, you know, so it may have been a different kind of goose. But then you begin to see, isn't that interesting that people were probably looking at tracks on the ground of geese, you know, and then they look up at a plant, and they say, oh, look at it, it's got that shape, and so does that one. And,
right.
You know, it turns out that they're very related in terms of how they grow and the little flowers, which are invisible, that they make and other things. And also there's a group of plants in that family that are very salty tasting. And four-winged saltbush is one. If you lick a leaf, you're out on a hike, you see when you lick a leaf, it's salty. or Atriplex is salty. It's very curious. And they tolerate alkaline desert soils.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Now, you have, we start with the carrot family.
Mm-hmm.
And the carrot family's got a lot of people in it.
It does. And it's an interesting family because the umbilifers are not only vegetables that are really everyday workhorse kind of vegetables, like celery and carrots, and then maybe less so celery root and fennel and so forth. But there's a lot of herbs in that family. You know, there's cilantro and parsley and dill and anise and cumin and caraway. It goes on and on and on. And curiously, you know, I just noticed that if I'm cooking carrots, you know, a lot of people put dill with carrots, but chervil's great with carrots. So is parsley. So is lovage. So, you know, our fennel greens. Every herb in that family seems to work very harmoniously with every vegetable.
So that's an interesting thing. First of all, some of these families are more vegetables, some are more herbs. A lot of them have both. And so if you cook the vegetables and the herbs from the same vegetable family together, they taste good.
They tend to taste good, yeah. So I would think that, my hope is that being somewhat aware of who's in a family would make a person feel a lot more daring in the kitchen and say, oh, I'm cooking carrots tonight. Let's see, I've got that funky lovage out there. Maybe I'll give that a try and, whoa, it's really good, you know.
So has this changed the way that you cook? Like pairing things or mixing things in that way?
I'm not sure that it has, but working on the book forced me to think about things in different ways. For example, the knotweed family is a really strange and kind of difficult family. I know.
Yeah. I looked at that. I couldn't recognize anything in it.
Well, it has buckwheat and sorrel and rhubarb, all kind of cantankerous. You know, plants. And then it has this wonderful herb called rau rum, which is used in Vietnamese cooking, which is quite delicious and different from those other three. But I started thinking, well, like among the umbilifers, all these things merge and go together so easily. Could you do the same with the knotweeds? And yes, you really can. You can make a galette dough with a little buckwheat flour in it, and then you could fill it with a rhubarb compote, or you could fill it with mushrooms and have a sorrel sauce. There are ways you can actually tie these together. Not that you have to, but it was sort of more of a challenge, like, could you, and would they work? And yeah, some of them are really nice together.
428-1393. We just keep giving the number because I think it's important for people to get a copy of this book and take it home and read it and look at the beautiful pictures. Now, I mean, part of the whole thing also, when you learn about the different plants and families, is also learning about the nutrition. And there's considerably different nutritional value in each one. And not that it's a nutrition book, but that's part of the whole journey also.
Yeah, I think I'm genetically adverse to publishing nutritional information about plants. I don't really like going for the numbers before you go for the flavor. It doesn't interest me. But in doing this book, I thought, well, I need to know everything about the plants. So I did a lot of reading on the nutritional components of every vegetable. And it's startling how amazing they are. Again, the caveat being that they're growing in good soil. But every time I'd read about a vegetable, I'd think, oh, I should eat that every day, you know? And then I read about the next one. Oh, I should eat that every day. The only one that wasn't so true of was cucumbers. Cucumbers is not exactly a powerhouse, you know, nutritional vegetable, but everything else seems to be. They're amazing.
Really?
Yeah. And you look at a family like the daisy family, which is a really difficult family. I mean, all those plants are bitter, they're prickly, they're hard to work with, and well, a lot of them are, not all of them. But it turns out that bitterness seems to be associated with something that's good for the liver. And milk thistle, which people, if they're getting a cold or their adrenals are off, they'll often take a tincture of milk thistle. Same family, you know, and it's bitter and it's good for you. and I thought, it's just so interesting that they really do cluster, you know, in these ways.
Now, that's the family that has sunflower in it and
yes.
artichokes.
Yes, and cardoons and salsify, but also lettuce. And lettuce used to be a very bitter vegetable. And it's been tamed over the years to not be so bitter. But if it's too hot out or it starts to bolt, it immediately gets bitter.
Ah, very
and
interesting.
And radicchio is in it also, and Jerusalem artichokes. And when you cut the roots of any of these plants, they exude this sort of latex-like milky liquid, which if you challenge yourself to taste it sometime, you'll be shocked how bitter it is.
But then again, bitters are... they're part of the medical herbal tradition. I mean, taking bitters is part of what we do to stay healthy, supposedly, or used to.
Yeah, tartness, bitterness, those are both sort of positive attributes. I mean, it was long a tradition to use rhubarb as a kind of cleanser. In fact, you can still buy a medicinal Chinese rhubarb plant from Richter's Seed Company. So it's still out there. But a lot of the members of that family were known for their medicinal qualities, like burdock, before they were regarded as a food.
We're talking to Deborah Madison, author of the new book, Vegetable Literacy. And this book can be yours by making a contribution. If you make a small monthly sustaining contribution, then you can also get a copy of the book. The number is 505-428-1393. And we had a little bit of phone action earlier, and right now it's been a little bit quiet. Deborah Madison has very kindly given us a contribution of her own. And we are just waiting for you to give us a call. Take home a copy of this book, or not. You can also just call and make a contribution to KSFR just because you think that maybe this is a good station to listen to. Maybe you listen to the Radio Cafe every morning and you think, I want this to keep going. We would like to listen to this show tomorrow and the next day and the next day. And ladies and gentlemen, it is actually a true fact that this is only possible if you make a contribution. 428-1393. And I have a message from the control room that the phones are ringing. Do we have any thank yous that we would like to make? We'll get a report from the control room in a few moments. But Deborah Madison, you want to talk for a moment about the value of public radio for you, like how it accompanies you during your day?
Oh, yes. Well, my day is actually spent writing a lot of times. I'm not listening to public radio. But on Saturday mornings, I have it on all morning. I love Saturday morning. And I have to time my visit to the farmer's markets knowing I have to give up at least a half an hour of something, which I really regret. It's been wonderful. And also this year, I joined a gym in town, and I go in early morning. So I've gotten into the habit of listening to the BBC News. Which
nice.
I love hearing the BBC. I really do. And it's a different perspective. I think it's very good. It's very informative. And I appreciate hearing that quality of news reporting and from the English perspective instead of always ours.
Very much so. And the BBC is not under the kind of fire that NPR is under every time they say something that a certain group of senators doesn't like. They threaten to cut their funding and all the kind of politics around radio that we have here. KSFR does not have those limitations. As far as I know, the BBC really doesn't have those kinds of limitations either. And we don't have them here on the Radio Cafe. We put the things on the air that we think people would like to hear, and that's it.
Yeah. I always hear something interesting on KSFR, and I think it's a very important forum for democracy to have this opportunity. We don't have we don't own a radio station in our community other than this. So
that's right.
It's really important.
428-1393, and the toll-free number is 866-907-5737. That's 866-907-KSFR. And we've got a $1,000 goal for this hour, and we are not quite halfway there. So, ladies and gentlemen, let's get the telephones ringing, and let's get a copy of this book into each of your hands, Deborah Madison's Vegetable Literacy. Now, in the book, Vegetable Literacy, you talk about using the whole vegetable. And
yeah.
I think celery can be a good example of that. I mean, In Europe, they eat a lot of celery root. We eat the stalks. And you can also eat the leaves?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, celery root and celery are actually two different plants. One is grown for the root. But when we buy a big block of celery at the market, for example, the leaves are wonderful. They're like parsley. They're very clean tasting. And the darker they are, the more potent they are. And I often use them if I'm making a soup with celery or a salad with celery. The leaves go right in it, too, at the end for that nice, fresh, abrasive quality that they have. But you could also pair the bottom of it, which we usually throw away, or use in a soup stock. There's no reason you can't pair that a little bit and then braise it or, you know, really base a soup around it. So, yeah, you know, when we buy vegetables, we're usually getting just parts and pieces of them. You know, we don't see the whole thing, and that's the beauty of having a garden or visiting a garden. You don't have to have the garden.
It's hard to have a garden.
It's very hard. And but if you take a farmer's market farm tour, for example, and you happen to be in a field and you see a cabbage and you see, my gosh, it's 3 or 4 feet across where you have all those greens. And what comes to the store or to the farmer's market is just this little tiny part of it that's been fed for sometimes months, you know, by these outer leaves. It's quite awesome, you know. Leeks are the same way. Leeks often have the names flag, like one variety is called American flag, because the leaves are about 4 feet long. And
what?
Yeah, the leaves are huge. They go on forever. And you could pick them up and wave them back and forth, like, you know, you could flag in a, you know, flag down help or whatever you might need. But we don't see those, of course. I mean, they're cut off and they're left in the field. And that goes for a lot of leaves. The leek leaves aren't so edible, but other things are. I did have an experience in my garden of letting the chard bolt one year.
What does that mean, bolt?
It means that it's going to go on and make seeds. It's done being your leafy green vegetable. It wants to now, you know, get long. And if it's lettuce, it makes towers of leaves. They're really pretty. So as it bolts, it gets tall and lanky, and the leaves get tinier and tinier and further apart. And so I was cutting this down, hoping that maybe some new big leaves would sprout. And I was taking it to the compost, and I thought, what if I ate these? Can you eat them? You know, so I took it all inside and picked off the leaves. I took some of the tender stems and cooked them. They were delicious. They're perfectly edible. But what's interesting is at that stage, they start to taste more like wild grains, like calipes, and less like a domesticated, tame green. It's like their true nature of that family starts to come out a little bit. So you don't have to throw that away. And the stalks make fantastic flower arrangements, and nobody will guess what on earth they are.
Oh, my goodness.
So there's a lot we can do with everything in the garden.
Well, and when it's all done, you can compost it, too, because that's another really important part of your garden.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely want to do that.
The telephones are quiet, ladies and gentlemen, so give a call right now, 428-1393. We have gone just about halfway to our $1,000 goal for this hour. So let's get the phone ringing and get a copy of Deborah Madison's book, Vegetable Literacy. Now, let's talk for a moment about the mint family. Not everything in this family is minty, so to speak.
No, well, it is and it's not. But, I mean, it's not conventionally minty for sure. This is a family that includes most of the herbs we use, aside from the ones we mentioned from the umbellifers. So it includes oregano, rosemary, sage, marjoram, mint, of course, and thyme.
Basil,
yes. But what's interesting about basil is if you crush a leaf and smell it, you know, it's a very complex herb, and there is a little mint in it, and along with clove, along with cinnamon, along with spice, it's a complex herb that you can tease the mint out, and you can use it sometimes where you use mint, like in a tea. It's delicious.
You know. So you make basil tea?
Yeah. Sure, you can just steep it in water and, you know, it can go in with lemonade or with lemon.
Now, this is another one. When you talk about these these herbs, when you, okay, you just mentioned sage and rosemary and basil, and if you make a soup or if you make, well, you don't eat meat, you're a vegetarian, but are all your cookbooks vegetarian?
Well, you could say this is a vegetarian cookbook if you look at the recipes, but there's lots of, you know, like this would be good with lamb or this would
be
good,
for example.
You know, because, you know, they have more applications than one.
But if you were to take various herbs in this family and combine them into a soup or with a piece of meat or whatever, again, they would taste good together because they're complementary and in the same family?
Well, in this case, herbs are so intensely aromatic and going off in such different directions that, you know, and this family, the mint family, is all herbs, so there you're going outside, you know, of course. But talking about being mint, you know, like when sage goes to, is in the spring, starts to flower and it makes these beautiful flower bracts with purple flowers, at that point, if you rub it and smell it, you can get the mint. There's this sort of mint quality about it. It goes away the minute the weather gets hot and the leaves get resinous and they get that kind of funky, strange, sagey smell that's so good in the fall.
Right.
You know, with winter squash. But there's a point in the spring where you can actually get the mint, the fact that it's in the mint family. Curious.
Very interesting. Now, it sounds like you've discovered new flavors and indeed some new foods in this process. Is that true?
Yeah, like rahram, for example, that herb I was mentioning that's in the knotweed family. You know, that is just a delicious herb, and I want to grow it this summer. You can buy it at Tallinn's and Albuquerque and maybe here now that we have a Tallinn, but
right.
It's definitely the herb that you'll recognize in Vietnamese cooking, and it's called a false coriander. And so people who don't like cilantro, they may not like this herb, or they may love it. I don't know. I think it's a little cleaner and fresher, and I don't know. I think it's delicious, but I think everything is so.
428-1393, KSFR Fun Drive. We've got another 20 minutes left to reach our modest $1,000 goal for this hour and maybe even go over it. The nightshade family. This is such an interesting one because it has in it so many things that we love and also poisons.
Yes, deadly poisons. It really does. And you know, some of the families do have poisonous plants in it, like poisonous hemlock. Poison hemlock is in the carrot family, looking an awful lot like osha or lovage or other herbs that we know. But the nightshade family has plants that are poisonous, and even the ones that we eat tend to have a lot of alkaloids in them, which have given them a bad name throughout history. You know, it was thought that tomatoes would cause stomach cancer and eggplant would cause leprosy. And, you know, it took a lot of doing to get people to eat these plants. I think one clever device is you call something a love apple, or you give it a name like that and say it's an aphrodisiac, which happened with tomatoes, and then
really?
That kind of
called them love apples, yeah. And said they were an aphrodisiac.
Yeah, and so, you know, then that goes a long way towards at least getting people to give them a try and then hopefully making them acceptable. But these plants have the most amazing stories in terms of their introduction, and especially the potato does, of course.
Tell us some of those stories.
Well, this happened both in Prussia and in France, that when the potato was introduced, people didn't want to eat it. For one, the Russian Orthodox Church had said it's not a vegetable it's not something we should eat because it's not in the Bible. And other people said, why should we eat this? Even dogs don't find it interesting. You know, it has no smell. It's, you know, it's not a particularly interesting thing. So there was a great reluctance to eat it. But at the same time, there were people who knew it could make a big difference. It could stand between starvation and a person. So what happened with Parmentier, for example, is he planted on the outskirts of Paris a big potato field. And he had it guarded. Well, the peasants looked at that and said, gee, there must be something valuable there if they're actually guarding it. And then at night, the guards went away. And the peasants would go in and they'd dig the potatoes and take them home and maybe eat them or plant them or do both. And this is a strategy that was done a couple of times in history. You act like it's precious and then you leave a little gap, you know, so that somebody can go and try it for themselves.
That is so funny. It's like, let's psych out the peasants.
Yeah, it's like something you do with kids or something. You
yeah.
know? But, I mean, there were big mistakes made with potatoes, too. When they were brought to the English court, the cooks didn't know what part to cook for this big estate dinner. And they didn't cook the tubers. They cooked the leaves, the stems, and the little berries on top, which
Heavens.
Are hugely alkaloid. And they make you nauseous. I mean, you get really sick. And I've eaten green potatoes to see what would happen, and that's what happens. It's just unpleasant. You
yeah.
don't die, but it's unpleasant. And it's said that that probably set the potato back about 100 years in England, you know, because that wasn't allowed in court at all after that.
Now, in this family of the nightshades, you've got potatoes, tomatoes, chilies, and all kinds of peppers, and you've got deadly nightshade and Jimson weed, which is that, I think of it as the Georgia O'Keeffe flower. Those
yeah, right.
big white flowers that grow like weeds in my yard. I love them. And somebody, a Mexican guy who was coming up the street, looked at it and said, oh, toloache. And which is the, I guess, southern Mexican indigenous word for Jimson weed. And he said, you make a tea out of the seeds, and you can get anybody to fall in love with you.
Oh, yeah. It's called a drug. Yeah.
It's called a poison. And then I looked it up, and it's a poison. It's a hallucinogen
right.
that will
yes.
kill you.
Yes, it can kill you. And belladonna, which means beautiful lady, was used in the Renaissance by women because it dilated the pupils of their eyes, and that was considered a form of beauty. And of course, you know, use in excess is probably isn't a good thing, but use in smaller amounts, it's what we all go through when we go to the optometrist. And we get our eyes dilated so that, you know, the doctor can look inside and see what's there. So you're going to get a very close look from your doctor, not because your eyes are so beautiful, but because it's possible to look inside when they're dilated.
And tobacco is also in that
mm-hmm.
family.
Nicotiana, yeah.
And I think people, myself included, who have a tendency toward arthritis and inflammation stay away from a lot of those plants.
Yeah, especially eggplant. And I thought that was always kind of an old wives' tale, but a year ago I had lunch with a group of women and I served eggplant, and some of them wouldn't eat it because they said that it bothered their arthritis
yeah.
or their joints. So it's still operative as a thought.
No, it's I've tested it. It's mm-hmm. operative as a reality.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're talking to Deborah Madison about the book Vegetable Literacy, and as I read in the nice interview that you did, or the article that Rob DeWalt wrote in the Pasatiempo last week, on which you're on the cover of, which
that
is
was
beautiful
a surprise.
Thing. Yeah, that was really beautiful. But is you, at first, weren't planning to make a cookbook, but everybody expects you to make a cookbook.
Well, if that's what you've been known for, it's really hard to get away from it. I thought maybe one recipe a chapter or something like that, but they wanted more like 300. And of course, it's not hard to do. I mean, you know, you're cooking every day. You have a garden. You bring these things inside, and there you go. But I'm glad in a way that they did ask for that, because it gave me a chance to include recipes that point to something else. For example, there's a recipe called damaged goods gratin, you know, of chard and tomatoes and eggplant. Well, we all are subject to hailstorms here, and you go out in your garden, everything is pockmarked and it's torn. It's maybe not ruined if you use it right away, but it's very hard on farmers because people won't buy blemished, you know, produce. But hey, I'm not a farmer, I'm not selling this, so I took it inside and I made a gratin out of it, and it was perfectly delicious, you know. But so just to point out, you don't have to, not everything has to look like it just came from the store.
Right.
You know, it can have blemishes, it can be hit by hail. A bug maybe has eaten part of it, but doesn't mean you can't eat the rest of it.
Right. Well, I think the history of survival in civilization has been eating stuff that we grow. I mean, not until the present day, or the, what, last half century, it was always blemished. That's how food is. And this sort of food museum quality kind of expectation is kind of crazy.
It is. And it's really, it's a big part of Big Ag. You know, and I remember when I lived in California, I went to a big ag farm, and they showed me peppers that were being discarded because they didn't have particularly even sides. You know, they were a little curved, they were a little lumpy, they didn't look like they wanted them to look in the store. As one of the reasons farmers markets got started in California was for commercial farmers to offload this so-called imperfect produce.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, a lot of it just got thrown away.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Didn't even get composted.
Probably not on those farms.
Yeah. We're talking to Deborah Madison. Now, in your book, Vegetable Literacy, I mean, we haven't gone through every single one of the 12 families of foods, but one of the things in these recipes is that there are certain staple ingredients that you use along with the vegetables. What are some of your favorite ingredients to cook with?
Oh, well, one of the, I love ghee. And this was sort of a new discovery for me, partly because a young man from Santa Fe moved to Berkeley and started making commercial ghee. And his mother gave me some, and it was so good. I went out and worked with him for a day in his factory, and now I'm completely hooked on it. It's called Ancient Organics, and I think you can get it at the marketplace, but it's really high-quality ghee made from Strauss butter.
Strauss butter?
Strauss is a family farm in Marin County that does beautiful grass-fed, you know, organic dairy products. And so ghee and coconut oil are two fats that I just discovered in the past few years.
Now, coconut oil, cooking with coconut oil, I like coconut oil because in the summer it's liquid, uh-huh, and in the winter it's solid in your house. Its melting point is somewhere on the high end of room temperature, I guess.
Yeah.
How do you cook with it? Does it flavor everything that you make with a sort of coconutty flavor?
It does. The coconut butter, which is actually includes the flesh of the coconut as well as the fat, I think is more flavorful, and that's what I've called for a lot in this book, not to cook in, but as a garnish, you know, to stir into a red lentil soup, for example, or there's a recipe for mustard greens with chiltepín peppers and a little coconut on top, coconut butter. And it doesn't melt as purely and as thoroughly as butter or the oil, but it leaves little white crumbles and these nuggets of flavor that are just so delicious. I'm really glad this has become an acceptable fat because it's a lot of fun to cook with.
I suppose you must have seen every fad that's come down the pike over the last decades.
Well, yeah, it's hard to miss them.
What are some of the ones that have stuck for you besides the coconut oil?
Well, I remember when goat cheese was introduced by Laura Chanel in the late 70s in the San Francisco Bay Area. And was it a fad or was it a trend? You know, was it going to stick? Well, that seems to have stuck.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a good thing. I love so many people are making not just little fresh cheeses, but howdahs and other kinds of cheeses using goat milk. And it's very delicious kind of milk. So that's something that started as a fad and became a trend and is now part of our food culture, which is great.
428-1393, and we've got more copies of the book Vegetable Literacy that anybody can pick up if they would like to do so. 428-1393 is the number of the KSFR Fund Drive, and we're pretty sure the Fund Drive is going to end today. We are getting close to reaching our goal. I think it's going to end today, so let's make it end during this hour by giving a call, 428-1393. Now, you use, Deborah, in your recipes also quite a lot of nuts.
I guess I do. I hadn't thought about it, but they're awfully good. Pistachios and pine nuts. And for a long time, I sort of stopped buying pine nuts because they're so expensive, but now I realize a tablespoon of pine nuts can go far, you know, for texture, for flavor, for a little special elan in a dish.
Right.
So why not?
Yeah, and they're so, I mean, if you're a vegetarian especially, nuts are so substantial and filling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they are in these dishes. And by the way, I mean, these are vegetable dishes. You know, they'd be great for a vegetarian. A lot of them are great for a vegan. And a lot of them, all of them, I would say, would be fine for an omnivore. You know?
Yeah, so. Exactly. No, I was reading through the recipes, and I don't cook as much as I probably should or would like to. And, you know, we can't all do everything or be everything. But I was looking at them, and it only occurred to me about halfway through the book, there's no meat in here. Because as I was reading them, I was having this vicarious feeling of fullness and satisfaction from these recipes because they're just so substantial.
But they're simple, don't you think?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I wanted them to be. If you have a garden and you go out and you pick something from the garden or you bring it home from somebody else's garden, the farmer's market, you know, you're halfway there. You're more than halfway there with the flavor,
yeah.
You know, with the texture, because this is food that is alive. It has energy.
We are in the KSFR Fun Drive, and we're about 7 minutes from the end of the program today, and we've got a report from the control room and some very nice people to thank.
Many people to thank. Here they are.
Yay.
Linda Milburn.
Thank you.
Nahan and Shelley Wardlev.
Yay.
Peggy Ader.
Thank you.
Andrea.
Thank you, Andrea.
Terry Mancott.
Thank you.
Robert Hake.
Okay, thank you.
Of course, Agnes Langdon.
Oh.
And Nirver Khalsa. Both of these people have called and contributed before, that, and maybe some of the others for all I know. Marsha.
Thank you, Marsha.
Dottie Hill, and of course, Anonymous. And
yes.
I'm going to keep you in suspense as to where we are. We could take a few more phone calls.
All right. Well, we certainly have been trying to reach our $1,000 goal, and we may be there, but we may not. So let us try to get there by the end of this hour, 428-1393, 428-1393. And we're talking to Deborah Madison about her new book, Vegetable Literacy. And Deborah, you'll be at Collected Works on Wednesday evening at 6 o'clock.
Yes, I will.
And now I have to ask you, I mean, how do you continue to come up with recipes? I mean, it's...
I don't know. I mean, you're just cooking, and I'm really, I think, at the end. You know, because it's not so hard to come up with them, but I think naturally in our lives, we tend to cook in the same way or cook with the same herbs, cook with the same flavors and methods over and over again, because we become, not just because we're lazy or bored, but because we also are comfortable with that. There's some nurturing quality that comes with repetition. And so I'm ready to say enough already until something really unusual comes to me. But in this book, it was interesting just because you're looking at groups and collections of plants that are related that you hadn't thought of before. So, you know, like quinoa is also in that same family, you know, with the spinach and the chard and so on and so forth. And you thought, oh, well, what about a little quinoa cake, you know, with spinach or with beet greens in it? And how about having some little beets around the side of it and pulling them together, you know, as family members? So, and by the way, this is only 12 plant
yeah.
families. There are many more. And I just, you know, they wouldn't let me go on forever.
Well, 12 is a kind of nice regular number.
It's a nice number, but there is another family I really wanted to include, which was the laurel family, Laurelaceae, because it has cinnamon in it, bay leaf, and avocado, among others. And I thought, they're mostly tropical trees, you know, and I thought, this is very interesting because we use the bay leaf for seasoning, but in Mexico, they use the avocado leaf for seasoning. It's a very similar shape, you know, but then you have cinnamon, and we eat the bark. That sounded like a really interesting family to pursue, but, you know, maybe next time.
So, yeah, you could do Vegetable Literacy Volume 2.
we could.
Now, what are your own comfort foods?
Comfort foods? I don't know. Because it's going to change all the time. You know, I'm very seasonally drawn. And I don't make macaroni and cheese particularly, although that is a very comforting food. I guess I like greens. I really like those funny goosefoots and amaranths and all the things you can do with them. And the squash family is probably one that I just pick up over and over and over again. And if I could really grow anything and grow it really well, it would definitely be winter squashes. They're just so great looking.
Now, do you grow them?
I've grown a few. I've tried. It's hard. You know, a lot of them take a long time to mature. The bigger they are, often they take more time than we have here. And I get, like other farmers, a lot of squash bugs. And they're just gross. And, you know, it's like I haven't really been able to deal with them very well. But I try because I just want to be able to produce my own really gnarly, warty, covered squash. However, I'm grateful to a couple of farmers at the farmers market who grow them. And they have a hard time with them, too.
There must be some predator who eats squash bugs.
There must be. And whoever can find that predator.
428-1393 is the number here at KSFR. And I think we have a report from the rather noisy control room. And Deborah Madison, I want to thank you so much for coming in and talking with us here in the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to be here.
And congratulations on another wonderful book. And can we just talk in the last moment of the show about the photography in this book?
Yes, it was done by Christopher Hersheimer and her partner, Melissa Hamilton.